From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. How important is Southern cooking to you?
I keep hot sauce in my bag, just in case some fried chicken pops off. And I try to regulate myself, but it's a work in progress. It's like somebody who's trying to get off of like crack or heroin or something. I'm trying to wean myself off fried chicken, man.
Today, we appreciate more than the taste of food, and we focus on its history. We'll also talk about how watermelon can convey certain racist stereotypes. That's ahead this hour, but first, my colleague Celeste Headley spoke with Jamie Allen. He came up with the idea for a squirrel census, a count of Atlanta's squirrel population.
They're great athletes, so nobody even had the slightest idea, which I thought was kind of funny because we do kind of know like how many rats are around, right? We have an estimate on that.
Good idea. Here at Mercer University in Macon, where I teach, the students like to joke that the squirrels outnumber them on the campus, and they might be right. Anyway, that segment got at least one of you thinking about the rat population. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, this is Bob. I have some dear friends from France, and when they were visiting a few years ago, we were driving and came around a curve and saw a very large possum crossing the road, and they were very excited and wanted to know what kind of animal it was. And I said, wow, that's a big rat. They were quite excited about the giant rats we have here in the South.
Thanks for that, Bob. We always want to know what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. If I told you all the awards he's won and movies and TV shows that he's made and the books that he's written, we'd have no time left to talk to the man himself, Henry Winkler. Most people know him as the Fonz, the slick teenage greaser, or ostensibly teenage greaser, from TV's Happy Days.
Could you move that up a little bit? Over to the left.
Winkler came to Georgia last summer for the Decatur Book Festival. He's the co-creator of a popular children's book series that centers on Hank Zipzer, a young boy with learning difficulties. And as Henry told Celeste Headley, that's something that he knows a lot about.
I was intimidated by reading. My eyes couldn't follow the tight print on the page. So let's take A Tale of Two Cities, let's take Ivanhoe. I couldn't read it. I dripped water on the pages. I let it dry. It crinkled up. And when I carried the book, it looked like I was abusing it. I read it so hard and never read a word.
So was it different for you then? Was it easier to read a script?
No, it wasn't. I was embarrassed for years because we did Happy Days for 10 years, Arrested Development for 3 years. You would sit around the table, you would read the script out loud, and I would stumble over every word, which not only made me feel bad, but then I would ruin the timing for my fellow actor.
So what was it like for you when you were actually diagnosed, when somebody explained to you why?
Nobody explained to me why. They explained to me about my stepson, Jed, who was in the third grade, and we had him tested, and everything that they said about him was true about me. And that's how I realized, oh my goodness, I've got something with a name. I'm not actually stupid. I'm not actually lazy. I'm not actually trying to be a troublemaker.
And since then, you've said you're an avid reader. You can't stop.
Well, I read slowly, but I love reading people like Daniel Silva, Lee Child.
Thrillers.
I'm slogging my way through Hamilton.
The biography. So then tell me about how do you go about creating these books that you know a young child who might also be dyslexic or have some other kind of reading impediment, how do you go about knowing how to write a book that will help them?
Okay. They're not for help. They are to make the child laugh. That is the most important. And then they happen to be about my life. what we found is that if I write the truth about the emotionality of what it was like being eight and what it was like not being able to keep up with everybody and looking around and saying, I want to read, I want to do math, I want to spell, and just having a brain that wouldn't cooperate. If you write the truth, kids write you back and they say, how did you know me so well? And when you write the humor and you make them laugh, all of a sudden they like reading and they write back and they say, my funny bone fell out of my body that I laugh so hard. And then you've got parents who write us and say, I walked by my child's room, I heard them laughing, I opened the door, and they're reading their first book they wouldn't read before.
Yeah, I want to read you this review I found on Amazon, and it says, quote, my 10-year-old son will only review this as so-so, but he lies. I said I would read these to him. By the end of two pages, he wanted to read every other page, and he wanted to read by himself. He is autistic. He still got the jokes and told me he likes stories about kids that are his kind of normal, you know, not magic or powerful, and they don't really get adults. Honestly, I wanted to see if Fonzie could tell a good story, but I'm hooked, and my son is not only reading without a fight, but with anticipation. How common is a story like that for you?
Well, first of all, let me just soak that in. I have not read that before, and that is so touching, I don't know what to do with myself. And that encapsulates the reaction that we get from the child, from teachers, from the parent, and then kids who don't have a problem learning read our books because they're funny, and they go, oh, that's why Max is like that. That's why Tiffany has that problem.
I'm speaking with actor, producer, and children's book author Henry Winkler, and I want to play a clip. You actually play Mr. Rock, one of your teachers, in the TV version of this series.
Yes, can I just say this?
Sure.
We could not sell Hank Zipser on television for anything. And I finally sold it to the BBC, where it was a hit for the last 3 years, in the top 10. And it's finally coming to America.
Well, let's hear a little bit of you playing Mr. Rock. In this clip, you're showing Hank how to play softball.
Okay. Hank, I am so sorry. You've got to take off your socks.
I play much better with them on.
I'm sure you do. We are not going to make fun of your toes. Unless, of course, they're hairy. At which time it's open season. Come on, as quickly as you can. People are waiting.
Okay, Hank. Easy does it. I need to hide these hideous, girly sparkles.
Okay, so is it true that the teachers, Miss Adolph and Mr. Rock, were actually based on teachers you had?
They were. Miss Adolph truly, I think, first of all, was related. And second of all, the worst teacher on the planet. Mr. Rock was the man who said to me, Winkler, if you ever do get out of high school, you're going to be great. And I held on to that one sentence until like last Wednesday.
I'm tempted to ask what happened last Wednesday, but I assume you're speaking metaphorically.
Yes.
I want to play another comment. And this is about your acting. This is Gary Marshall, and he's talking about your portrayal of Fonzie.
I'm watching the show. I like the tough guy, played wonderfully by Henry Winkler. He wasn't at all like Fonzie Henry Winkler, but he could act. And he just made guttural sounds and had ho-ho and hey. And a lot of them Henry made up himself, whoa-ing and hey.
So how different is the job of author, especially children's book author, from the job of actor?
Do you know what? That's an interesting question. As a matter of fact, I don't know that I've ever been asked that before. So let's look at that. Okay, so here are the similarities. You're using your imagination. As an actor, I read what the author has written about the character, what people say about the character, and how I feel as I am talking the lines to another human being. And then you put that all together, and then you put that through who you are, and you bring yourself. As an author, I'm walking around Lynn's office, or I'm sitting in the rocking chair on the other side of her desk, and I'm using my imagination and my instinct, and I just let it flow, and out of that comes the book. Lynn, we participate completely intertwined as authors. I mean, it is not, these stories are not as told to. I talk, she types, I wait. She reads it back to me, and then we argue over every word.
I find it interesting that your fellow actors have often described you as a collaborative actor, somebody who likes to be part of a troupe, I guess.
Yes, that is true.
And you've also chosen, as an author, to be a collaborator as well.
I would not be able to write these books on my own. I mean, I am so lucky that I found Lynn. Otherwise, these books would never have gotten started. In the beginning, I was convinced that there was no way I could write. And so what I tell every child that I meet, every human being that I meet, you don't know what is lying inside you waiting to come out. And all you have to do is put one foot in front of the other and try.
How difficult will it be for you to say goodbye to Hank and Cheerio and the iguana and all the other characters in the book?
It will be difficult to say goodbye, but it is also time to let it go. And I, outside of my children and my grandchildren and my labradoodle, I don't know that I am prouder of anything I've accomplished in my life.
It has been a real pleasure.
Can I just say this?
Sure.
I cannot wait to meet you. I'm not kidding. To get up to come to Decatur, you do that only to meet you, whoever you are and whoever shows up.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's true.
That's actor and author Henry Winkler speaking last year with my colleague Celeste Headley. He was in Georgia for the annual Decatur Book Festival. Just ahead, we talk with the filmmaker behind the classic movie Fried Green Tomatoes. But first, the connection between Southern food and the civil rights movement? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. All this hour, we are looking back on some of the best conversations with Celeste Headley, who stepped down this week as host of On Second Thought. She spent some delicious time on this show talking about Southern food. It has a history as rich as its taste, whether it's red beans and rice, cornbread and pot liquor, fried chicken, fatback, or biscuits. The history of this region's fare stretches from slave plantations to the Montgomery bus boycott to our own award-winning chefs today. Culinary historian John T. Edge is the author of The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. He's also the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and Celeste Headley spoke with him last year.
Can we start with what potlicker is? Can you call this a salvage food?
Yeah. So potlicker is the boiled down essence of a pot of greens or beans. If you throw a hock in and you throw turnips or mustard, throw a ham hock in or turnips or mustards and you cook it forever and a day, the liquid leavings at the bottom of the pot, that's the pot liquor.
And the irony is that when the pot liquor is where all the nutrients are instead of the greens that were pulled out.
It is. In enslavement era South, masters would remove the greens and reserve them for themselves. And the great perversion here is that the nutrients resided in the liquor, which the masters deigned to give to the slaves to feed them.
And this idea of salvage food, food mm-hmm. that was trying to use every bit of a plant or animal, you describe that as being particularly Southern. Why?
We were poor for a long darn while. And out of poverty comes inventiveness. Out of poverty comes this ability to render beauty out of tragedy. And poverty is a tragic condition in which to live. And yet, out of that poverty, out of that need and want to eat close to the land, we created this beautiful food that sustained Black and white Southerners during the years after slavery, during the years of sharecropping and the like.
So you started this 60 years ago. You cover six decades in this book. Why did you start where you started?
1955 is where I began, and I began with the Montgomery bus boycotts. And that's where I believe the South begins to change. Fitfully, yes, but the modern civil rights movement is catalyzed by the brave Black men and women of Montgomery, Alabama, and changes the whole of the South. And if you want to apprehend Southern food, you want to apprehend what the South is becoming. 1955 is the year to begin.
That's John T. Edge, author of the book The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. In his book, John T. dives into the connection of Southern food with the civil rights movement. In Atlanta, Pascal's Restaurant was a regular gathering place for leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. It's still with us today, and you can order some of the same tasty fried chicken that King ate. Marshall Slack has worked there for years, long enough to have served King. In a 2014 interview with NPR, Slack said that the restaurant's owners gave King and other civil rights leaders a place to organize.
He wanted to form the coalition and integrate restaurants and motels and schools, but he didn't have any money and didn't have anywhere to meet. So he and Andrew Young and all of them came up there to see Mr. Pascal, and he let them use one of his suites in the hotel. And by them not having any money, he only requested one thing. Dr. King said, "What is that?" He said, "That y'all eat my fried chicken."
For more on the role of food in the civil rights movement, Celeste Headley talked again with culinary historian John T. Edge. Celeste also brought Adrian Miller into the conversation. He is a self-defined soul food scholar.
So, John T., let's go with where you began the history portion, which is in the civil rights movement. And you start with this cook named Georgia Gilmore. Why do you start with her?
Because she embodies everything possible about linking food and civil rights. Georgia Gilmore was a cook, a midwife. She literally laid track on the railroad. She was a woman who comes from meager means and recognizes that she too has much to contribute to the movement. At the very first meeting of the Montgomery Improvement Association, when Dr. King takes the mantle of leadership, when Rosa Parks steps to the stage to receive applause for her bold stance, her refusal to go to the back of the bus, Georgia Gilmore was there at that very first meeting, and she brought a hamper of fried chicken sandwiches because she knew that her cooking could serve a role. She could raise money for the bus boycotts.
Let's actually hear from Georgia herself. Her group was called the Club from Nowhere. And here is Georgia Gilmore talking about that club in a 1986 interview for the PBS series Eyes on the Prize.
And so the Club from Nowhere was able to report maybe 150, 125, or 75, maybe $200 or more a week. And which was very nice of the people, because so many of the people who didn't attend the mass meeting would give the donation to help keep the carpool going.
Adrian, there's this kind of joining of both something really practical, and that's the cooking of food and the selling of food. Everyone's got to eat, right? And then the more symbolic stance of that. How do we place Georgia Gilmore in civil rights history?
Well, she's an important figure like so many other citizens who, used what they could, their skills, what they had to support the movement. And I think there's a wonderful symmetry because the restaurant space, the eating spaces, were one of the most contested spaces in the civil rights movement. Because when you sit at a table with someone, you have to accept their humanity. And I think that's why there was so much resistance to desegregating restaurants and other eating spaces. So I just think it's such a wonderful push and pull for that struggle for humanity.
And you go on in your book, at least, John, to talk about other people who made this connection between civil rights and food. Why did that, was that connection intentional from the beginning? Did Georgia Gilmore know what she was doing?
Georgia Gilmore most certainly knew what she was doing. She leveraged skills and knowledge that she had learned cooking for her family and cooking for white families as well. And so many people did. Gilmore, like Fannie Lou Hamer, recognized that the first fight was for public accommodations for restaurants. Second fight was voting rights. Third fight was for economic justice. And Fannie Lou Hamer pivoted like Dr. King did late in his career. She pivoted to focusing on economic justice and argued that to raise your own crops, to have control what we now think of as food sovereignty. It's a term we use now. But food sovereignty was the ultimate goal for African Americans, was the ultimate goal of the civil rights movement, to control your means of production. So that was a civil rights issue, that was a human rights issue, and links right back to Georgia Gilmore.
And that kind of brings us to the issue of appropriation, John T., because for this food that, as we've mentioned, has such a deep meaning in terms of pride and independence. Then we get to the part where the many of the people that we know that started championing Southern food were not African American at all.
Correct.
So why?
Why does that happen?
Yeah.
It happens because as Southern food gentrifies in the 1970s, really the 80s and 90s is where it begins, Southerners, white Southerners, discover new value in this poverty-engendered food. So in the 1980s, this new generation of chefs who are rehabilitating the South and rehabilitating and weaving new narratives about the South, they begin to open restaurants, and they call these new Southern restaurants. 1982 is kind of the watershed year. Crook's Corner opens in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Highlands Bar and Grill opens in Birmingham, Alabama. And the difference here is these are white chefs with access to capital. Frank Stitt, famously, his mother mortgaged her house so that he could open a restaurant. That sounds like she took extraordinary steps, but the reality is she had a house to mortgage. So access to capital means that white chefs are able to step in and tell these stories. So now when we talk about cultural appropriation, at the root problem there, it's issues of capital still. And it was evident in 82. It's evident today.
That's John T. Edge, author of The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. We also heard there from food historian Adrian Miller. His latest book is called The President's Kitchen Cabinet. Both of them spoke with Celeste Headlee. The watermelon was once a symbol of pride for freed slaves, but it's since taken on all kinds of racial connotations, not all of them positive. Pat Turner is a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's also author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence. She spoke with Celeste Headlee.
When did the change occur between watermelon being something that Mark Twain praised in his writing and people just talked about a delicious fruit to something that is associated with a particular race?
Well, I think that the association of blacks and watermelons really dates to the minstrel era in the middle of the 19th century. This is the time period where the most popular stage shows involved white men dressing up in blackface and mocking and deriding black life as they perceived it in the South. They would exaggerate the size of their lips, the clothes would be sloppy and slovenly, and these stage shows became enormously popular really through the end of the 19th century, past the Civil War, and there was a whole subset of them called Tom shows, which were modifications of Uncle Tom's Cabin that became musicals and were really popular.
And it became, the watermelon became part of those minstrel shows? Why?
Well, food became part of the way in which popular culture could convey an image of blacks as savage. So any food that you could eat with your hands, watermelon, fried chicken, corn on the cob, these were the foods that were given to denote African-American characters as not having the civility that comes with eating with utensils.
This has become a controversy. Before we get to some of the more modern controversies, let's go back to the 1970s and hear a little bit of the TV show All in the Family. And in the scene, not surprisingly, it was his character, Archie Bunker, is expressing his distaste over integration in his neighborhood.
Archie, 12% of the population is black. There should be a lot of black families living out here.
Yeah, this is only a beginning, but I think it's wonderful.
Wonderful, huh? Well, let's see how wonderful it is when a watermelon rinds come flying out the window.
How did we get to the point where that became ubiquitous? Any ideas? Because we went from minstrel shows until we get to the 1970s where you don't even have to explain the racist joke.
Yeah, it never subsided. And when I say minstrel shows in the 19th century, think about the most popular tweeters today. You know, think about when you think about popular culture, this was on the covers of sheet music when sheet music was a primary way in which people communicated music. I have to explain this to my students that before people even bought records, they bought sheet music because you played music yourself on your piano at home, the covers of which had blacks sitting on watermelons, spitting watermelon seeds. So it goes from one generation of popular culture item to another, all the way up and through All in the Family.
So in 2014, the Boston Herald published a cartoon, and the cartoon was actually about security breaches at the White House, but it featured the president, President Obama, brushing his teeth, and there's an intruder in the White House who asks the president, "Have you tried the new watermelon-flavored toothpaste?" That caused an uproar, and the cartoonist Jerry Holbert told WMUR-TV that it never occurred to him people would see that as racist.
I just think watermelon's a flavor. It's a popular flavor right now, and that I would go ahead and use it. And maybe this is very naive, and I'm sure that it is. It's very naive on my part, but I just don't think like that. And I really didn't think other people thought like that, especially up here in the Northeast.
So let's contrast that, a white cartoonist explaining that he never occurred to him to think of a watermelon as racist, with comic Phoebe Robinson, who says she avoids eating watermelon around white people. She's speaking here with WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful.
So I was in Whole Foods, and I was in the checkout line. They had, like, this thing called, like, watermelon juice, and I felt like they were mocking me. Like, I can't put that in my cart because everyone who goes to like Yoga to the People will think that's what black people do. Right. So I'm like, I'm gonna leave that there, but I can't do it. Like when I dated my ex, he was white, I dated for 4 years. I never ate watermelon in front of him.
When we talk about the watermelon as a symbol for black culture, is that something that there is a racial divide even on how we perceive that?
I think it can be. I do think that reporter was probably correct in his self-assessment that he was particularly naive. You know, if he's a professional journalist, I think he ought to be a little bit more in touch with certain things than that was indicated. But African Americans, many of us grow up being taught from our earliest days how to avoid conforming to the negative stereotypes that our parents and grandparents had to deal with. So the comedian had heard from her parents about the days in which it was far more ubiquitous and all of the things, and not eating watermelon is just one in an inventory of things. You know, don't be late and, you know, make sure your hair is neat and use proper English and walk proudly. A whole inventory of behaviors that are intended to negate any holdover of the negative stereotypes.
Are we now getting to the point where this particular stereotype might be ready to die out within a generation or so?
I think it's possible. It's often hard to for stereotypes to die. You know, if you or your listeners Google, you know, put Obama and watermelon in Google Images, you will come up with lots of very contemporary cartoons making that association with him. You know, there's something very, very tenacious about stereotypes and about derogatory images that makes them very hard to eradicate completely.
That was UCLA professor Pat Turner. She's author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence. She spoke with Celeste Headlee. Just ahead, we hear from the filmmaker behind the classic movie Fried Green Tomatoes. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. All this hour, we're looking back on some of the best conversations done by Celeste Headlee, who stepped down this week as host of On Second Thought. The 1991 film Fried Green Tomatoes tells the story of a housewife played by Kathy Bates, who befriends an elderly woman named Ninny, played by Jessica Tandy. Ninny recalls the amazing story growing up in Alabama. The film centers on the murder of Frank Bennett, an abusive husband of Ninny's friend Ruth. Celeste talked about the film in 2016 with its director, John Avnet. At the time, the Atlanta Film Festival was preparing to show the movie to mark its 25th anniversary. It was, of course, filmed in great measure in Georgia. Here is their conversation.
One of the things that a lot of critics pointed to was the fact that the book made the relationship, the romantic relationship between the two central characters, very explicit. You chose not to do that. And what I find interesting is that while critics pointed to that and said that was a failure of the movie in some ways, it still got an award from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation for the best feature film with lesbian content. What was your reaction to the sort of the two dual interpretations?
Well, the dichotomy has a lot to do with point of view. First of all, it's inaccurate to say the book was more demonstrative in terms of the relationship. Actually, if you look at it, it was less demonstrative. There was just one particular line, which was not as strong as what was said in the film. In the film, when Mary Louise Parker was on the stand, she says, "She's my best friend and I love her." And I think a lot of people had political intentions in what they wrote, and they were writing about a world that they knew very little about. The customs and behavior in different parts of the country have been different over time. And a lot of times, women have had many different kinds of relationships. And the drawing of what becomes a gay relationship is a definition that when the film came out was different than it is today. I think people look at gender fluidity in a much more sophisticated and realistic way. At the time, you were either A or B. I don't find that to be the truth. What was important to me in doing the movie was that we could explore relationships between women, all forms of relationships, and explore intimacy between women. And this was not something that was commonplace at the time. Actually, it's not even that commonplace now.
Yeah.
And that was my goal. That's what moved me. And I believe that's what moved an audience. And it's also why it traveled between both gay audiences and straight audiences. That was something, you know, I didn't think about. I was just hopeful that it would be moving. And I think to a greater extent, it was.
This was one of the first big kind of breakthrough roles for Kathy Bates. What did you see in her or like in her that let you choose her to star in this film?
Well, I wouldn't use the word like. I would use another four-letter word, and it would be love. She's just a phenomenal actress who I'd seen a number of times on Broadway. I was very, very happy to have the opportunity to bring her to a screen. And I was just imagining her and Jessica Tandy for the roles that they played in Fried Green Tomatoes. She's just a flawless, truthful actress and also has deep Southern roots, which I think was quite important for this movie.
I wanted to play a little clip here because this was one of my favorite moments, actually, in the film. This is in the scene in which Evelyn is Kathy Bates' character, and she's talking to her husband, and she's told him that she plans to bring Mrs. Threadgood in to move in with them in their home.
It's never going to happen. So just forget about it.
Don't you ever say never to me. Someone helped put a mirror up in front of my face. And I didn't like what I saw one bit. And you know what I did? I changed. And that someone was Mrs. Threadgood. She needs my love and care now. And I'm going to give it to her.
So this was not, you know, growing up in the Los Angeles area for me, this was not my image of the Southern woman. And I wonder how you felt about these particular moments, these moments in which Fannie Flagg, who ended up writing a large portion of the script for you, was herself flouting Southern stereotype.
First of all, Fannie and Carol Sobieski, who were the credited writers, wrote a bit of it. I wrote most of it. I was not credited. So a lot of those, all those words are my words.
Really?
So, oh, yes. And by the way, it was a bit of a contentious thing. But if you ask Fannie, are you looking, you know, a number of things she said, she's been very, very generous about that after the fact. But what the story was about was the power of storytelling and how it could affect people. And particularly, obviously, it was Kathy Bates' character. And in many ways, it was, to a lot of New Yorkers, very behind the times. And in some ways, many people in the South were a little slower to adopt things. But it is naive, it is simplistic, and it is degrading to describe Southern women as less than anybody else. And that was something that really annoyed me. And the way that Kathy grew and how she grew was endemic to her character, and her character can't be delinked from her upbringing and being part of the South. But there's a power to Southern women. There's always been a power to Southern women, and to say anything else is just ridiculous. So for me, you know, to see her bloom, to see her blossom, to see her love come and turn into action, not just words, within the context of a relationship that was, you know, to some extent prototypical or archetypal, that was exciting. That was fun. Kathy really went with it. And I love when she said to Ed, you're trying to kill me. She says, if I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands.
What the hell is this?
That's a low cholesterol meal. Happy Valentine's.
God, are you trying to kill me?
If I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands. Stop in the name of love.
So the anger that she was feeling is part of being liberated. And I think this is a story of her being liberated by these two women who she's learning about.
Since you brought up Carol Sobieski, I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I understand that the first sort of draft she brought to you was a musical.
Yes. Carol was a brilliant writer and a wonderful woman. And she was my first choice to adapt this. And she was really enamored with The Singing Detective, which was a wonderful piece by Porter and BBC put on. And I told her what I wanted, and she said, look, John, I really get it. Would you let me do my version first, and then I'll do whatever you want? Literally, I will do whatever you want. Well, she wrote this, you know, musical where the past and the present, they were all singing together and getting together in the nursing home, and it was wonderful. It just wasn't the movie that I was going to make. I asked her if she would now, you know, honor what she said. She did. She took a shot at it. And then very honestly and very openly and very, in a very emotional way, she said, John, either you should write this or Fannie should write this. I'm the wrong person for this. And volunteered not to continue to be paid and actually said she didn't want credit. Of course, she passed away before the movie came out, and that became moot. But she was a classy woman, very, very talented, and I thought incredibly honorable.
Frank Bennett won't be bothering you no more. You understand?
You killed him.
No. You don't believe me. Right now, I don't know what to believe.
The movie actually is sort of structured around this story of the murder of Ruth's abusive husband. His name is Frank Bennett. And I want to play a clip from the film. This is when the sheriff goes to the Whistle Stop Cafe, and he's...
You ain't fooling me, girly girl?
Yeah, exactly. Let's take a listen.
What we talking about is murder here. Running afoul of the law, and don't nobody get away with that. Not even a bunch of Alabama smart alecks. If I find so much as a half his head, I'll arrest you fast and you can slap a tick. Because I'm the law, and you can't beat the law.
You're laughing. Why does that make you laugh?
I love Rainer Schein, and I love his accent. I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed, I love the Southern voice. I just love it. And I spent quite a bit of time listening and trying to study to get a sense of, you know, where people were from and what the roots might be. But mostly it's the music of it. And, boy, he is musical. And so I love that. I just love that scene. You ain't fooling me, girly girl. I know who you are. Yeah, he was great.
Although I just talked to Jack McBrayer, who introduced the film at the Atlanta Film Festival, and he has a very recognizable Georgia accent, says he can't get any work in the state.
Well, he should wait for me to show up, because I love the sound of the voice in Georgia and Alabama. It's a little different in some of the deeper southern areas than the northern part of Georgia, Tatum up there. But it's quite interesting, the whatever the etymology of the voice is. Something I'm not an expert in, but something I enjoy listening to very much.
It's interesting to hear you say that, though, because the thing I hear most often, especially from people working in Hollywood and in the movie business, is that when you use a southern accent, it's most often assumed that person is dumb.
You know, those people didn't see the Watergate hearings and haven't been cross-examined by a southern lawyer recently. I would posit that behind some of that local quality is a rare and very incisive intelligence, as well as, you know, a kind of what I would say being a little bit more at one with nature than people who are city folk. Part of what I love being down south, many things, but there seems to be an ability to enjoy life. And to understand that there were rhythms to it. And it was something that actually touched me and made me ask questions about my own existence, which were more citified, I think is the word Fanny would use.
I wonder how it changed your filming that you were able to completely design. Again, these are all things I've just read from different coverage of the movie, but I'm told that when your production designer found the Whistle Stop Cafe, it was not a cafe, it was an antique store, and you got to build that horseshoe shaped counter specifically
Yes.
because it was better for filming, right?
Yes. Barbara Lang was the production designer, and when she brought me to Juliet, which was like a ghost town covered in kudzu, very few people, this antique shop, which I was told was open 1 hour a week, was situated in a way that it had a view of a railroad track that was only being used to bring coal down to the power plant. And I had hoped I could convince the powers that be that I could put a period locomotive on there. That was a long, long story and very difficult to do. But with the, approval of the various federal agencies and the railroad agencies, and when we had our railroad man there, Sid, we were able to do it. So it had a great view because back then we didn't have CGI. So putting a train next to the
interesting.
Whistle
think
stop.
About that.
And when you think whistle stop comes from, the whistle. Right,
the train whistle.
Exactly. And by the way, we also found the depot in the woods with trees growing through it. And my Georgia boys from Macon, the Grips, cut down the trees, built a little road, and they rolled the thing, put it up by the tracks.
You're kidding me. That building was original.
That building was original. I mean, obviously, we redid it, restructured it, and so on and so forth. But it was original, and we put it where it was. And then in terms of the design of the cafe, again, Barbara was a very talented designer, wonderful collaborator, just a very talented woman. She showed me that horseshoe design, and I went, do it. Let's do it. Because it gave me the ability, one, to see the tracks. Also, I could see out back where Smokey Lonesome would be with Mary Stuart Masterson when he was having the shakes. And you could also see Cicely Tyson, who's a big part of this movie to me, poking her head in and out of the kitchen there with George, Big George. And it just created a world. And we were also able to, use, a lot of elements. Like we had these amber shades in there that gave a real color, a warmth to the place, which could be pulled up or pulled down. And one of the key images to me was the sort of that gunshot through the window, that yeah. Spidering of the glass. And if you actually look at the movie in terms of telling the story visually, the first time you see it, you see a spider, then you see the window being painted with fried green tomatoes served hot at the Whistle Stop Cafe. And then you see the night when the Klan shows up and they blow out the window. And you could tell the story in many ways visually just through that image. And, again, a lot of this was Barbara's imagination. She actually showed me a shot of the spidered glass for no purpose at all. And I went, oh, I like that. I like that. I can use that.
I wonder what you hope the movie's legacy will be.
You know, I'm a sort of not closeted feminist. I had done in 1984 The Burning Bed, with Farrah Fawcett. That was about domestic violence, and it was an important movie to me and an important movie, much more importantly, to many women who were battered.
And the Fried Green Tomatoes is also about domestic violence.
Yes, that is a theme that you will see in my pieces, and you will see more coming up. Because I just hate it. I just really despise the fact that, women historically started out as chattel, I can't pronounce it properly, but were enslaved, and, you know, the fact that violence was used against them just is obscene. So at any rate, you know, this was yet another opportunity to tell a story that had an element of that. So what I wanted to get across, as I said before briefly, was I was so interested in why so many women are closer to women than to the men that they're married with or their fathers or their children, you know, and whether they were gay or straight. That seemed to be something that was worth exploring. It was and is a phenomenon that I don't think a lot of people have written about in ways that have really moved me or educated me. So that's what I wanted to explore.
I've been thinking maybe I should move on because of Frank and all. I just don't want you to feel like you have to look out for us. I just don't want to be selfish, that's all. Maybe if I wasn't here, you'd settle down.
I'm as settled as I ever hoped to be.
Something happened after the movie came out. Many people wrote a lot of things, and I read as much as I could because I wanted to learn from it. But about 6 months after the movie came out, a young girl, about 10 years old, whose mother was a professor at Cal State Fullerton, I believe, really liked the movie, and she kept asking her mother to see it again and again. The mother said, why? The young girl said, because it's good. And the mother said, well, what's it about? And she said, it's how we tell stories to keep people we love alive. And I went, oh, that's what I was doing. I needed a 10-year-old girl to tell me what I was doing. And that is true for the movie and probably true in my life for people who I care about who've passed away and, you know, and who are influences in me. And I've always felt that on a certain level, I'm an extremely fortunate person that I get to tell certain kinds of stories that not everybody else gets the opportunity to do.
That's filmmaker John Avnet, who directed the 1991 film Fried Green Tomatoes. It was filmed in Juliet, Georgia, north of Macon. He spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We're asking what your favorite Celeste Headley segments are. She's stepping down as host of On Second Thought. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk, and we're on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.